Josina, thank you for coming in today. You've got a marvelous career. You've done some wonderful contributions to the world and to your community and your region. So again, thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for having me. I feel very honored.
So Josina, there's always inflection points in people's lives, and it could have been something that happened when they were, you know, 3 or 5, maybe something happened in school, maybe a friend or family member. And then later on in their life and career, there's these inflection points that really made you who you are today. So can you talk about some of them?
Yeah, wonderful. The interesting thing is, you know, when my career, which has basically been in the technology space, the first interest for that happened when I wrote my space law thesis at Leiden University, because I wrote my thesis on the international legal applications concerning remote sensing of the Earth from outer space. And thinking back on choosing that specific topic made me realize what I missed about when I was a little girl in kindergarten and primary school. I always used to be such a curious and investigative child, and I wanted to know everything, and I was like a sponge and soaking up. And we had this wonderful library at the school, and I think I was the learner who most of all learners in the classroom would say, no, but I want to do a presentation. I let me write do this poem, and let me organize the play. And what that thesis brought to me, I realized that my high school years and the first years of my law study actually had been a lot about just absorbing knowledge, but within a confined space. You know, this is the curriculum, this is the content you need to get to know. And there wasn't a lot of room for exploration and curiosity or creativity. And choosing a subject for my thesis, which was completely out of the realm of ordinary law topics, but looked it into what's happening in outer space, and how technology in outer space actually can contribute to things that are happening on the planet, made me realize that I missed being that girl from primary school who was curious and who was willing to push boundaries and then see what you can do with that knowledge that you obtain. So I think, yes, thinking back to that girl, that's wonderful. And I think the rest of my career and life has been following that trajectory since, always looking for new opportunities, exploring different specialist fields, and then realizing, well, actually, I'm not a specialist. Maybe I'm more of a generalist, and then moving on to the next. Obviously, also my move to South Africa from the Netherlands was a big exploration in itself.
Excuse me. So I'm curious then, you have this thesis and it sort of triggers memories when you're younger, and there's curiosity that you had and continue to have, and the wonderful work that you do. So when you were young, was it sort of innate? It's like other members of your family were like you, sort of curious about all sorts of things, or were you an outlier, different in the family?
Different, yeah. Yes. So, and sometimes I know I scared my mother at times with that, you know, being this, you know, one of her catchphrases was, why can't you be like other children? She didn't really know. I've got this child, this precocious child, and all the teachers say, oh, she's smart, oh, she's curious, oh, and she didn't know how to really deal with that. I don't come from a family where I was the first in my family to go to university. So that was all, new to them and scary, more scary to them than it was for me, yeah.
So when you were young then, were you curious about nature and art and music and science and math, just everything, or were there some things that excited you more than other things?
That's a good question. So I loved reading stories, jokes, but I was learning about the world, I think, most of it. So our library was called at the primary school, it was a world orientation center where you could find information about, it was like a sort of an encyclopedia. So it was really looking up other countries, but also what do whales do and the giant panda, but also how does the heart work and lungs. Lots of different topics that piqued my interest.
Were there any topics that didn't pique your interest? Things that you thought, no, I don't like that subject?
I wasn't a big fan of math, but I could also have fun with it. So yeah, math was less of an interest to me.
So then you have all of this curiosity and you're an anomaly in the family, and people are wondering, geez, she's so curious. And probably that curiosity has a lot of energy. And that energy drove you then into studying what kind of subjects when you went to university?
Yes, so for me, it was always balancing a bit. What happened in high school was, you know, you follow the curriculum, a bit bored, and then suddenly you realize you have to choose, you know, what am I going to study? And then with this wide imagination and interest, it's actually hard to choose something. And also with quite a lot of talents at my disposal. So the reason I chose law is actually horrible. At that time on TV, we had LA Law. You probably remember it. And I remember those lawyers standing in front of a jury. And I thought, no, I can do that. I'd like to do that, you know, put forward a case and be convincing and find out what's happening in there. And that's actually why I chose to study law. And that's a thing that my father was a bit concerned about, because although he didn't really know how to deal with me, he was always very intrigued by me and thinking, no, this child has got potential. And he even discussed it with my high school mentor, where he said, she's choosing law. Isn't that too generalistic for a child so talented as my daughter is? And that mentor said, it doesn't really matter what Josine is going to do. Whatever she chooses, she will find her own way and come out on top and using it for her. And law in itself, you know, it's a good foundation to have. It helps you with analytical thinking. And so, but like I said, after a couple of years studying, you know, civil law and penal law and all the boring stuff, I then specialized in international law and most specifically international public law. And that's when you get to talk about concepts like the law of the seas, space law, air law, and the fascinating concepts of common heritage of mankind. When we talk about the open seas or about Antarctica or about outer space and the moon. And that somehow really, really triggered my imagination. And it was also, things are happening there. And you know, if you talk about what's happening in space, technology is being developed and activity is being deployed there for which we actually haven't got laws yet. So this is sort of uncharted territory. And then how do we deal with that? How do we make sure that what's happening there? And that I found more fascinating than learning, you know, which articles in the law would speak in a specific civil case or in a penal case. So I ended my university studies on a high note with that thesis.
So just one sort of more question, because, you know, I come from North America, and on our, and you, when you go into law, you normally get an undergraduate degree in something. And then you go into law school. So it's like a two-part process. You get a degree in economics and commerce or something like that. Then you end up with going to law school for several years, and you article and so on. And there's this sort of process. It's quite a long process. Is it like that in Europe, or describe what it does to be a lawyer in Europe?
Yeah, so in the Netherlands, that's a bit different. And to be honest, I've never practiced as a lawyer in the Netherlands. But the law studies, you do start after, so you start at age 18. So high school is until you're 18. So that's grade 12, I think, for you. And then you immediately choose, or at that time, I know it's changed now, but this was over 30 years ago, you would choose, you know, you study law. So then you just have law subjects. And then, you know, you've got your propedeuse, which is your first year, which you have to graduate. So that's only 1 year. And then you can continue. And then after a couple of years or 2 years, you can choose your specialization. So you can become a fiscal lawyer and obviously if you want to become a lawyer practicing law, then after you've graduated your law degree, then you will have to go in an internship in a law firm and to do what you probably call, you know, write your articles and before you become a member of the bar. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, all these differences around the world. So, okay. Mm. So you go into this international public law and then you specialize in this, or at least part of the time you specialize in the space aspect, right? And can you describe some of the sort of intriguing things that you found about space law and what are things that we should be concerned about now and going into the future?
Well, so the most interesting thing about space law is that the main concept is that because space is common heritage of mankind, you know, all exploitation should be done for the benefit of all of mankind. And I think that's something that we've, you know, over the last couple of years no longer taking into account. And I must say, probably 30 years ago, 40 years ago, also other things happened, but it was a lot less intensive than what's happening now. But if, for example, if I look at my thesis, which was looking at remote sensing, what was interesting there is that, you know, any country can launch a remote sensing satellite. You know, there are some rules around it is that you report it to a certain office at the United Nations. This is the activities that we're going to do. But it doesn't, there are no really rules that guide what you do with that remote sensing satellite. But we have to remember that remote sensing satellites actually take pictures of the Earth. And on the Earth, there's a different law system in place than there is in outer space. Because you take pictures of the territories of countries. And on Earth, you know, we've got this concept called state sovereignty. So you can't just, for example, fly over another country without having permission. But now from outer space, you can suddenly take photos of the territory of another country. So that's where, you know, the whole crux comes in, that certain countries became very concerned about it. Because obviously, and this was at the time where we still had, you know, the Eastern Bloc and the socialist countries and developing countries, as opposed to the developed nations, who did have the capability to put up remote sensing satellites. And they were concerned, you know, if you take photos of what's happening in my country, you have the capability to see, for example, what subterranean riches you can find there. So especially African country with all our, you know, the rich resources that can be found there, and what are you going to do with the data? So it's that was the interesting, that's what really piqued my interest. Outer space is free. On Earth, we've got state sovereignty. And actually, the activity doesn't remain in outer space because the data from the activities of the remote sensing satellite are being sent down to Earth, to the ground stations. And then what do you do with the data that you get from there? So yeah, for me, that was a very interesting topic to explore.
And because you got this sort of background, and but you moved into other areas as well. But when you reflect back with what you learned at that time, and you see what's happening now with commercialization of space, and you see the geopolitical tensions that are occurring, you see that the moon is being reinvestigated again by many countries, not just the U.S.
Absolutely.
India, for example. You see Mars as part of this sort of equation today. There's this concern that maybe the Earth isn't a habitat that can continue for a length of time. And it's kind of, some people believe now we have to look at other options. There's more than one space station up there, and there's geopolitical divide into who can use, who's invited to a space station and so on. There's this idea of asteroids and mining asteroids, and they've even taken a sample of an asteroid and brought it back to Earth. There's this whole idea of space, existential threats from space, a comet or some kind of object hitting the Earth, and really thinking now, what does that mean? And is there ways that we can forestall or prevent some kind of catastrophe happening on Earth? So now it's changed so much, and there's so much space capability and commercial space companies. What's your opinion on all of that?
In a way, concerning. So if I look at it, from almost a philosophical point of view, I feel like, we are not able, to make it work on Earth. We don't abide by international law. We've got geopolitical tensions. We still exploit, poorer countries and poorer people. And, if with that attitude, and obviously, only people who've got money to do that can go into outer space. If we take that attitude into outer space, I don't feel that whole peaceful use of space, of outer space, that opened my heart when I learned about it, that we're going to be able to maintain that in any shape, way, or form, apart from accidents that will probably happen due to the busyness in the geostationary orbit. And there was the funny incident happening last week of the astronaut losing his toolkit. But there can be collisions, and parts of satellites can come crashing down to Earth, and we can't protect ourselves against that. So apart from those accidents, it's also the intentions that we as human beings take in outer space is what mostly concerns me. Because as much as I'm for pushing my own boundaries and learning more, it's always do no harm. The concept of do no harm. We probably have to think about, do we do harm if we start to explore and exploit Mars or the moon, or send more commercial aircraft into space? And is that where our attention should go? While there's all these, if imagines, that's what I sometimes think. Imagine if all the ingenuity that people put in these exploits they would put towards solving world problems, what would happen to those world problems? And I never really understand what that drive is, huh? What makes you decide to put your money in your skills and your talent and your ingenuity behind that. And maybe in the far future, we will find out that they were right and Earth has exploded and they were the founders of new colonies on the moon and Mars. I don't know.
You know, globally, it's also, and especially in North America, there's this sort of reawakening that these unidentified area phenomena, there's something. They don't know what it is, but they think it's real now, right? Mm-hmm. And space will have some connection with it, perhaps, right?
Yeah.
There's an admission that there's something, right?
Yes.
They don't know what it is, but there's an admission.
But isn't that like the old maps, you know, the old explorer maps where, you know, parts of Earth that hadn't been discovered yet and the maps would just say, here will be sharks or here will be dragons, you know? So parts of space or the universe that we don't know yet, there will be, unidentified flying objects, and they might be space sharks or space dragons.
Right, and perhaps they have a perspective of us and what we're doing in space, whatever they are, if there is a
thing. Exactly, yeah.
And they would be curious as well, maybe concerned.
Yeah, so, for them, maybe we are the sharks and the dragons.
That's right. We're the scary ones, right? Okay, so you're in the Netherlands, and my perspective of people from the Netherlands, they're very practical, and sometimes it's kind of like a joke, right? Maybe blunt sometimes, or straightforward, right?
Yes.
And you come from that society, very practical. And I can see why in the family that they'd be questioning about you, because you're thinking in such a big, expansive way. And there can be a little bit of tension because you're practical, or there's that practicality of that region. Or that's my perspective as a North American who does a lot of things in Europe.
Mm.
And then you end up in South Africa. How did that happen?
Yeah. I get asked this more often, and there's a very long answer and there's a shorter answer. But what happens, I had this lovely career at KPN, corporate career. And like you said, Dutch is very practical, and it's also very direct. And I think my parents were happy because I did my law studies and I finished them and I started a corporate career. And then you're sort of expected to walk this path. And, you know, and then your friends and they get married and they get babies. And I was like, yeah, happy for them. Not sure if that's what I want. I enjoyed the work that I did. And then I went on a holiday to South Africa. So the job I did at the time at KPN was manager of product development of fiber to the home. So remember, this is 20 years ago. So this was one of the innovation departments. And I thought it quite fascinating, you know, working with the network architects and the network engineers who were frustrated with marketing because they couldn't anyway. So I was the lovely interlocutor between technical and marketing. But I went on holiday to South Africa by myself, but in a group, but I was by myself. And from the moment I landed at Johannesburg Airport, I don't know, something happened. In hindsight, it felt like I was home. I don't know, there's some calm came over me, like, okay. And I had that feeling during the whole journey. And I had one, yeah, I can say I had an epiphany in not in South Africa itself, inside South Africa, what Lesotho. So part of the trip took us to Lesotho, to a very high mountain. There's a backpacker's lodge called Malealea. And it's one of the most beautiful places on earth I've ever seen. But it's also one of the poorest places I've ever seen. And it was a Saturday, and we were there as a tour group. And because the tourists who come there basically sponsor the school in the village, on a Saturday morning, we're going to pay a visit to the school. And now all the children had to come to school on a Saturday because the tourists were there. And we went into the classroom, and it was all lovely and interesting. But I couldn't, what happened there, you know, my fellow tourists started handing out pens. And these children started saying, thank you very much. Thank you for our school. And I thought, no, this isn't right. This doesn't seem right with me. So I had to go outside sitting, you know, it was really, it sounds very dramatic, sitting on a mountain top and thinking, you know, thinking something is out of whack here. You know, I never chose to be born in the Netherlands. You know, that's what happened. These children didn't choose to be born on this beautiful mountaintop in Lesotho with no opportunities whatsoever. And I'm in the Netherlands with all the privileges and opportunities. So why are we sitting here and are these children thanking us because they can go to school? Education is a basic human right. You shouldn't have to thank anyone for that. It's a basic human right, it should be there. And that's where I had sort of the insight, you know, with all my curiosity and my skills and my analytical skills and the management skills I've now got, maybe, you know, there's a purpose to this world that says, you know, people with skills and talents and everything actually need to use them for areas where those skills and talents aren't yet, instead of the work that I was doing in the Netherlands, which was, you know, developing new products and services for KPN, the telco I worked for, to even make more money out of clients that we already have. You know, that's pumping money around. Is that a purpose? Is that purposeful work? So that was one of the things where I thought, well, that's actually interesting. Apart from the fact that, you know, because you need to find a reason to make it acceptable to people that you move. Because just saying no, but I felt like I came home, is much more difficult for people to grasp. So, yeah, it took me. I went back to the Netherlands after the holiday, and I became very, yeah, I think that it was sort of existential crisis, you know. So what am I doing in this life? And there is so much more to do in the world. And also, I wanted to explore why do I feel at home in South Africa? What is it there for me? So it took me less than a year to get it organized. So I took an opportunity at KPN. They were doing retrenchments. They wanted to keep me, but then I had to promise not to talk about South Africa anymore. And I said that. So what if I want to keep talking about South Africa, but then I would be part of the program for retrenchment, and not because I talked about South Africa, but because I chose not to do the job. And I took that package, and that allowed me to facilitate my two first exploration trips to South Africa. And I pretty quickly got some consulting work. So I packed everything and I moved. And that was the beginning. Yeah. And an interesting move, like you said, coming from practical, yeah, you said blunt, direct. It can be very direct and blunt, to South Africa, which is much more gentle. And it was a I don't know. Yeah, I don't exactly know why I did it, but it was one of the best things I've ever done.
You felt some kind of a synchronicity and harmony when you went to South Africa, a oneness with that region and the people and the culture and the history, which you didn't really find where you were. That's kind of the sense I get, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that oneness, that harmony, that synchronicity, that unity, that integration that happened when you landed and then went into South Africa. So what did you do? I mean, you had to work. So what did you do?
Yes, so I thought, because at the time there was talk of a second national operator. So I thought, no, let me continue my corporate career, but in a South African corporate. But to be honest, making that move by myself, and I had my own business cards printed, and I thought, no, I like being this independent. Why would I become part of another corporate? You know, I was never unhappy in a corporate, but it wasn't the optimal environment for me. So I thought, let me see if I can get to work as an independent consultant. So, yeah, through just phoning people, and that's a good thing about being Dutch. you find your way into places. I very quickly had a first consulting job with MTN, which is one of the main mobile operators. So it was a strategy consulting job, and a second job with the Department of Communications, which was looking at how do we get internet to all the schools in South Africa. So it was also a strategy job. So yeah, working as a consultant, that's how I started.
And, you know, so that would mean, like you said, your Dutch background, you're not afraid to pick up the phone or make that cold call and say, hey, this is who I am. I worked in telecommunications in Europe, and I have skills that will be of value to you. And these are the things I can do. And you end up getting hired. And so what were the initial challenges when you worked as a consultant and you're putting internet through schools? Because putting internet or working in the mobile environment, there's just going to be differences in South Africa versus working in fiber optics in Europe. So can you describe those differences and what you learned?
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, I quickly learned to observe before I spoke.
Well, that's different than usually for Dutch, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but you know what? But I immediately made some mistakes because things are different. And like I said, people are much more gentle. And to be honest, I looked, you know, it offered me what I was looking for in the Netherlands, you know. So my bosses at KPN would sometimes say, yeah, you're great at the job you do and you can really go very far, but you are a bit emotional, you know, you need to get that in check. And then I thought, but no, you know, I should get my emotional side in check, or maybe you should open up to that a bit more. So I really enjoyed having that a bit more emotional side. Because remember, when I came to South Africa, it was just 9-10 years after first democratic elections. So all the trauma of the struggle was still very much, it actually still is, but especially then, was still very much there. But it's also, I don't know, it's sort of, it opens people up, and the conversations you get in, I'll never forget those first meetings I would be in. Because if you then start talking about how important it is to get internet into schools, the mobile operators were mostly black owned with black personnel. So it was all new, and it was all so geared towards doing things for good.
Right.
So I thought, no, this is really, really, you know, where I'm at home. But it also meant, you know, treading carefully, because, you know, I'm a white woman. I'm a woman. That makes it a bit easier, but I'm white and I'm not from South Africa. So that might make things easier. But people don't immediately, you know that when they look at you. So it's and I thought I would have to be more careful with that, but people were actually very welcoming and bring your skills and we need them and how can we work with that? So it's a completely, it was a much more conducive environment for how I wanted to work. But then obviously there's also a difference between working at a mobile operator or working at a government department, because that's the corporate environment. And that already started to feel a bit more like the corporate I knew in the Netherlands. Whereas at government level, there was even more than at the corporate, much more drive towards, we need to get all the people on board and included. And it's it was a tough challenge then, and it's a tough challenge today still, because we haven't figured it out yet after 20 years in South Africa.
But it would be a tough challenge, but an exciting, energizing, inspiring challenge, because you said, like you said, it's for good, right?
Yes, yes. And then, but then still, you know, it's also, so I remember the strategy I wrote for the Department of Communications is saying from the get-go, you don't do this by yourself, you know, because then there's talk about we need to start our own operator. No, no. Get your public-private partnerships going, because, you know, including everyone and educating everyone is not just the public good, but it's also in the interest of these businesses. Mm-hmm. Because how can you be sustainable in the longer term without a population that has the skills that you will need to keep on growing your business and to keep innovating? And apart from, but also with clients who know how to work with the products and the increasingly innovative products that you build and bring to market. So we need to look at public-private partnerships and see how we can make that happen. Because you, as government, you've got a public, you know, you've got your public objectives that you need to fulfill, and companies. Because at KPN, I also worked in Eastern Europe, where KPN went to. And there the governments would always say, you can buy the mobile license, but that comes with the responsibility to also connect rural areas. So that's the universal service obligations that came into it. So how do you balance all of that? But it, you know, sometimes I find it surprising that for businesses, this feels like tasks that they have to complete, you know, a universal service obligation to connect the unconnected or to have specific rates. So for schools, we were talking about an E-rate, where schools would be connected to the internet at lower rates than the commercial rates. And I thought, you know, education is so relevant to having a thriving economy, you know, for the benefit of us all. So yeah, no, it's very exciting, but it's also, it's a very long-term project. So the excitement comes and goes, as does the frustration. Yeah.
Yeah. And people don't say you're too emotional.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
Isn't that wonderful, no. Right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, you're even, you know, you're more being blamed for being too, you know, too businesslike. So, yeah. 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 No, so, and I learned a lot. Eh? So it's lovely how you say that, but in the Netherlands, you know, and I think that's part of being an immigrant in another country. And I chose to come here, where you look back at your own country and you think, no, everything, all these things are much better in South Africa, and I wish I was born here. But at some point, there's also this balance where you think, no, but actually the Netherlands has given me so much. And all this practicality and bluntness and critical thinking, I think that that's a very Dutch trait, where we're being taught in critical thinking, you know, and now it's touted as one of 21st century skills. And I think, well, critical thinking is what I have learned in the Netherlands, not just in school, but also in the corporate environment. So one of the differences between the Netherlands and South Africa was that if I would present something in a management meeting in the Netherlands, well, before you'd finish talking, people would start, you know, but what about this? And did you think about that? That's not going to work. And how about that? And in South Africa, and I presented to the executive management, and I presented. So I was, and in a way, I like it because, you know, all these questions, because it elevates the work that you're doing, because you bring in different perspectives and it keeps you sharp. And I presented in South Africa, and they just thanked me for my presentation. And I was like, yeah, but don't you have questions? So at that point of, you know, I missed the mark. You know, what I've presented to them doesn't speak to what they want to know. But then afterwards I got feedback. I thought, no, this is, but you know, for me that felt a bit like a missed opportunity. So that critical thinking skills, you know, and it made me think about that over the past few years when we talking about how important it is to teach children critical thinking skills. I think, well, actually I've been taught that. And in the Netherlands, it's flipped from critical thinking into judgmental thinking. So, you know, it's there's a fine balance between being analytically sharp and then attaching a judgment to it, to things that you see. But the skill in itself is a very useful one to have.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a critical thinking in this terms, with a theme of optimism. So you look at potential challenges and barriers, and then you could get very solution oriented and optimistic. Exactly. That we could overcome. Exactly. This.
Yes, definitely.
That's, you know, that's fascinating. So can you talk about some of this work, things that you want to get internet everywhere? You're working with the Department of Education and things like that. Can you go into more detail of some of the things that you're doing, and where you feel it's a 10 out of 10, in other words, are like an 8, and so more work to do? It's not, you know, it doesn't mean it's bad or failed. It just means there's just more work to do.
Yes. Yeah. So if I, very potted history of the work in education and what I'm doing now and what I see, what needs to happen going forward is, so when I did that first consulting job at the Department of Communications, I worked with somebody, Tobeli Tengemfena. I really want to mention him here. We unfortunately lost him during COVID, but he moved from Department of Communication to Vodacom, one of the other main big mobile operators in South Africa, and he moved to the foundation. So he became responsible for their corporate social responsibility program. And then he found me. So he worked there for a year, and then he found me. He said, Josina, what we've come up with at the department, the public-private partnership, I've got it in place, and now I need you to do it for me. So then I came in as a consultant at Vodacom, and we set up the Vodacom Mobile Education Program, which involved setting up teacher centers, district teacher development centers in every district. And there's 145 education districts in South Africa, and outfit those teacher district development centers with computer centers. And that was a public-private partnership with Department of Basic Education, Vodacom, Microsoft, Intel, but Vodacom was the driver behind it and the integrator of the whole program. So it started with challenges where I said, now let's start with one center in each of the provinces. And the whole, and that worked. So that was a bit of a long haul. And then, because then you find out if national department says yes, doesn't mean that the provinces and the districts know about it. So that's more, but that's what other people were responsible for. But we were looking at how we're going to set up these programs. So we came up with programs where we said, we need to have connectivity. We need to have infrastructure. So that's computers, laptop, tablets, whatever we need. We need to have digital content and teacher training. And those were the four pillars that the program was based on. And I'm actually very proud of what we achieved there, because we moved from 9 centers in the first year to 92 centers a couple of years later. There really was a good program around it. Things that worked, didn't work is... connectivity remains a problem in rural areas. So even if centers are connected, doesn't mean they have broadband connectivity because the operators haven't made that available yet. We've got challenges with security. So outfit a lovely computer center and the criminals in the area will know about it soon. So these centers come under attack. Most amazing thing, I think, is the people that work in these centers. I always find, we sit in Joburg, we come up with all these ideas for programs, and then you come into the rural areas and find out what we've come up with doesn't really work. But by working with people who do work on the ground, so the department has e-education specialists and e-learning specialists and center managers, and if you work with those, that cross-pollination really worked well. It's never the enthusiasm and drive and passion of people on the ground, because they want... I've fallen in love with teachers during this project and people who work in education, because they work with a passion. They say, no, we need to prepare our children, because if we don't, it's going to fall. And what I've learned is that the difficulty with if education becomes a corporate social responsibility project, it also has a lot of, because they have to spend that money, those are legal obligations. But it's also a branding, marketing, branding PR issue. And the attention span is sometimes shorter than you need for a project to really succeed. And the budgets that are allocated to it are not big enough to really make it work. Because even if you have these four pillars ready, the connectivity, infrastructure, content, and teacher training, it doesn't mean it flies. It needs a lot of attention and hand-holding. And especially when you look at the teacher training, it's, we say we give you once off training and then we expect you to go back into the classroom and actually do it. It doesn't work like that. We also don't work like that. If you've learned something new, it takes some time and going back and forth, and how do we fix it? So that's also why I, 5 years ago, established my company, Flying Cows of Josie. Because I said, this is the missing link in what we do in education. So Flying Cows of Josie are recently graduated teachers who've specialized in ICT in education and who act as coaches for teachers. So instead of big ones of training programs, we need to have a lot of more, ongoing hybrid models of face-to-face, webinars, WhatsApp support, and understand how the technology integrates in the curriculum. Are there pedagogical strategies that are at the heart of what we're bringing into the classroom. Because otherwise, you don't want to know how many, I call them the digital white elephants. You know, we've got beautiful elephants in South Africa, but we've got plenty of digital white elephants, which are computer centers in schools, which are not being used because people, it's not a lack of willingness, but they don't know how to. And that's a bit my next drive, maybe. Let me not call it a frustration. Let me call it my next drive is to make clear, you know, we talk these days about human-centered technology. But then we must also be willing to pay for the human beings to bring the technology to other human beings. So if we look at the edtech industry, and I've tried to participate in a couple of those, you know, incubator funds for edtech companies. And the first thing they say, so what's your platform? What's your app? I said, no, I'm not bringing more technology. We're not going to solve the problem education by throwing even more technology at it. I think they're brilliant edtech solutions out there, but as long as we don't, or if we don't want to invest in the human beings, you know, getting to integrate and actively use these edtech applications in the classroom, we're just going to be, you know, be creating more digital white elephants. So there's this sort of mind shift that I think needs to happen, that I'm trying to drive, where you say, yes, I believe in technology. Yes, I believe in technology for good and environmentally conscious technology. But if we talk about human-centered, you know, we need to look a bit further than just looking at, you know, do we abide by the human rights? Do we protect people from misinformation? But we need to train people properly, and we need to pay the people who train the people to do that. So it's actually investing in human beings working in edtech.
No, we're down to the last few minutes. In fact, we got about 2 minutes left, and there's so much more I could talk to you about. So let's talk about what you're doing with the Institute of Information Technology Professionals of South Africa. So, because you are a director on the board and you chair, so can you talk about some of the work there? And then one final question after that is, what's your recommendation to the audience? Saying you got 2 minutes, roughly.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. It's good that I like challenges. No, so the work on the board. So I first came, was a voluntary member of the Institute in the Social and Ethics Committee, where we worked at getting the IFAB Code of Ethics slightly adapted for the South African circumstances. So the fascinating thing about the IITPSA, so Institute for IT Professional in South Africa, is, you know, like in most countries, we've got an ICT skills gap, but I think our gap is a bit bigger than probably in the Northern Hemisphere. So what can we do as an institute to contribute to creating awareness around that in the industry? Because it's great that we look after IT professionalism, and that you know, people come into the country with critical skills visas are educated by the institute. But we also have a role to play in creating awareness in the country on the dearth of ICT skills, and what can we do as an industry to work with that. And my role in the Social and Ethics Committee was really looking at, so I love chairing it, saying, how can we create awareness and education around the code of ethics? Because ethics is like, oh, boring. And to be honest, you know, for most people, you know, you don't want to be bogged down in the development work you do by talk about things, you know, have you taken this into account? And I think, you know, our task has become easier with the enormous emergence of AI ethics. Suddenly everybody's talking about AI ethics. So there we try to create awareness by having webinars where we combine. So we talk about blockchain and say green blockchain. So, you know, one of our ethics committee comes on board with a specialist on blockchain. We talk about responsible AI. So that's the work we do at the Institute. And so what we're doing this year is looking at how can we have a much better ICT skills study in South Africa, where we're not only looking at the demand side, but also what's happening at the supply side in ICT skills. So, okay, how much longer have I got left?
So you got about 30 seconds. One
30 seconds. So one recommendation
to the audience. Yeah. And I want to congratulate you on the David O'Leary Award, a global award.
Yes. From
IFIP-IB3 of professionalism. So, but yes, one final.
Was wonderful. Yes. Actually, yeah, just taking it back to what I spoke about earlier. So, if you work in digital technology and you want it to be a sustainable, want to be it sustainable for the future, let's make it purposeful and invest in human beings working in technology. Yes.
So thank you so much for coming in. I could spend a half our day with you. You just have such fascinating work and you're such a great contributor to the global community and you're in your region as well. So thank you again for coming and sharing your insights with our audience.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stephen. It was really lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.